This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Is the FA Cup too magic in a gripping bore-off? It's Boreham Wood who stunned Bournemouth. 37-year-old Mark Ricketts goal sees a non-league side into the fifth round. Kidderminster are just seconds from joining them. Boo Declan Rice and his West Ham cohorts for dashing the dreams of the Carpet Men. In Championship beating the Premier League, Manchester United are knocked out on penalties by Middlesbrough at Old Trafford, and Leicester are absolutely walloped at Nottingham Forest. Elsewhere, Plymouth's penalty agony at the Bridge, a first win for Frank Lampard's Everton, and a scratchy 3-0 for Luton at Cambridge. Also, Senegal win AFCON for the first time, a tale of two Sadio Mane's penalties, including the decisive one in the shootout. Susie Rack joins us for the WSL. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Simon Burnton, for the duration, welcome.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Thank you very much. I am fine. I'm good, even.
Oh, yeah. You were in the West Indies, weren't you, for the...
I was, yeah.
How was that?
I was in Barbados for 12 days to cover England's 2020 series there. It was almost unforgivably good. it was indecent to be paid to do that. It was wrong. I was furious. For a lot of the time, I was quite angry. But the rest of the time, I mean, I was just walking around with a big smile on my face.
I'm delighted. I'm sure all the listeners will be pleased to know you had an all-expenses paid 12-day trip to Barbados. And thank you for subscribing to The Guardian and giving us all your money. Ben Fisher, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Are you all right? Been anywhere nice?
Nowhere as exotic as Simon, that's for sure.
Well, you couldn't go to Barbados unless you had, you know, an Auntie Barbie, could you? The way that you only go on holidays for people, for places with your family's name in it. Wilson, Jonathan Wilson, out in Cameroon, welcome.
Morning, how are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you very much. Let's start with the FA Cup, move on to AFCON in part two. Bournemouth 0, Boreham Wood 1, a non-league side into the fifth round, only the 10th time that's happened since World War II. And there was something, Simon, about the full-time whistle that just made me well up. It happens every time, you know, the manager, Luke Garrard, with tears in his eyes, the chairman just hugging people. It was just glorious, wasn't it?
I think that this was a particularly good fourth round weekend in that it not only had upsets, and it had a few nearly upsets that didn't quite come to fruition, but generally the lesser teams just played great. They weren't just back to the wall for 90 minutes and score a scrambled terrible goal from a set piece. They outplayed opponents, and at Bournemouth, what, they had two shots on target. The only disappointment was that I watched 4.5 hours of football yesterday. I watched game after game after game. And I can't really complain, but I chose to watch the AFCON final over Bournemouth-Bournemouth. And I didn't feel that that decision was rewarded.
No, probably not. We'll get on to whether the AFCON final was any good. But Ben, I mean, 37-year-old Mark Ricketts, only his second goal, I think, in about 200 appearances. And what a brilliant finish it was as well.
Yeah, great finish. Or just took it nice and calmly in off the post, which is always bonus points, isn't it? That's nice. And yeah, I mean, Bournemouth were very ordinary, and Boreham Wood really, it's a really good performance, you know. It reminded me a bit of the way that Kidderminster played against West Ham, obviously, the day before. It wasn't just like they obviously had to dig in, but they played some decent stuff, and Bournemouth were really poor. And it's just a great story. I mean, I think the chairman remortgaged his house during the pandemic to be able to play, to pay rather all the staff in full, their full wages. You know, and to get a trip to Everton now, I think you saw one of the players, Kane Smith, I think the fullback, wearing a Tony Hibbert Everton shirt in celebration because he's a big Everton fan. And it's just a great story. And obviously, I know the tie at Bournemouth, as great as it was never going to be massive financially because of the gate receipt, and obviously the crowd at Bournemouth, not the biggest, but to go to Everton is the kind of ultimate prize, really, in that sense. And yeah, brilliant. And to have a non-league team still in the competition this far, yeah, just superb.
I thought Scott Parker at the end, I mean, that post-match was absolutely made for some streets, dry your eyes, mate. But I think that's the interesting point you make, Simon, is And I know we all know that these players are really good, but you kind of presume they're just not, that even though Bournemouth made a lot of changes, they had a decent side out. And yet, you know, Boreham Wood were playing like a high press and like looked like every inch as good as them for large parts of this game.
Like Ben said, you can take it and the Kidderminster game on Saturday as like two chapters in the same book of non-league sides who really should have been cowed by their opponents. I know Bournemouth are a step or two below West Ham and Boreham Wood a step above Kidderminster. But instead, take the game to them. But I think this was a great weekend for English football. That games that could very easily have been boring were fascinating. Results that could have been predictable were instead shocks. Teams who should have sailed through, scuffed through. And from Friday evening, the first match of the round, to Sunday evening, the last, it was exciting all the way.
Well, I think there is something really interesting happening in non-league football at the minute. And not just at the minute, but over the last sort of decade. I went to see CM Red against Ashington in, I think it was in October. And I was just stunned by how good the level was. And that's, what, seventh tier? And so I was talking to a few people there. And, fans and coaches were both sort of saying the same thing, that they've seen the level rocket in the last sort of 10 years. And they put it down to 3G pitches. That non-league teams now can play up from the back because they can trust their first touch because the pitches are good enough that you're not just playing percentages all the time. You can sort of rely on the ball coming to you fairly smoothly. And that has a sort of a self-perpetuating effect because kids who are coming up, you know, playing in their teens for those clubs are playing that way from the start. So I think the level of non-league football in England now has never been higher.
You were at Agbra. Ben, for Kidderminster West Ham. I mean, there was this moment in that game, like when Matt Preston booted it clear in like the 91st minute and the crowd cheered to think that is the clearance. That, you know, going slightly against, you know, going against Wilson's beautiful tick attack and non-league football, that was just hoof and we've done it. And it's just heartbreaking that West Ham managed to get through.
Yeah, I mean, it was going to be arguably the greatest, you know, FA Cup upset ever. And then it was the sort of cruelest finish I think I've ever seen. I mean, it was just, to do it once, it was pretty heartbreaking, the Declan Rice goal, which was a great finish. And then to wriggle out of penalties with 13 seconds of extra time to play, it was just extraordinary. Kidderminster were brilliant. Again, West Ham were really poor. David Moyes knew it as well. Declan Rice, really the only player who actually brought a bit of something to the game, brought a bit of order to the performance. I think I've still got the "Kiddy are massive everywhere we go" chant in my head from the weekend. It was pretty relentless from that North Stand terrace. I mean, it was a proper occasion. I spent a bit of time there on Tuesday last week against Leamington, and you could sense then it was building up to what would be a great day, and Saturday was just above and beyond that. I think for all the people there, all the volunteers and the staff, and yeah, just an amazing day for Kidderminster. It's just such a shame they just couldn't get quite over the line. And as Russell Penn, the manager, said after, you know, it's going to be that one that the players talk about, saying, you know, we were that close. Ridiculous really when you look back.
Tell us about the noise when Alex Penny's goal went in, which was a good finish actually, I thought.
Yeah, great finish, side foot, and just balmy, wasn't it? I think Kidderminster, they really sensed it was on, you know, getting into half time as well. Obviously, massive ovation. And I mean, just like you said about Matt Preston a minute ago, Max, there's just some great moments involving him. I mean, the moment where he took the ball, he sort of hounded Saeed Benrahma on halfway and then just did this amazing sliding tackle. I mean, that was like a goal in itself. Just some great moments. And I think after, I should say as well, that I think West Ham's players, including Declan Rice, showered with Kidderminster's players after. Apparently the home dressing room's a bit roomier, a bit more comfortable than the away. And facilities probably a tad better too. And I think West Ham were really good visitors in that sense. They did loads of, you know, they swapped shirts and all the rest of all those sort of classic things. But Declan Rice, on the way out of the ground, escorted by a big sort of security guard, made a point of having his photo taken, loads of autographs, just stopped for everybody that wanted it. And I know it sounds a bit, why can't he do that? But it was great to see. And like I said, the whole occasion just seemed to really grip Kidderminster and probably myself too.
Aidan says, I love the juxtaposition between the advertisements in the opposite corners at Kidderminster. One is for McDonald's new vegan-friendly plant-based McPlant burger, while another, presumably for a less global operation, encourages punters to try our half-pound steak burger. And John Bruin tweeted a wonderful picture of the Kidderminster's manager's office with the manager's desk being kind of a normal sized desk, and the assistant manager has just a tiny weeny desk next to him. Obviously Kidderminster doesn't have that much room, but it does look like Dr. Evil and Mini Me. Like, it's absolutely, it's just perfect. The angle of the photo as well, he's like, his knees are like sticking out the side, it's like a clown car. It's so good. Daniel says, is the magic of the FA Cup reliant on hot food being served at Old Trafford due to a technical error? They couldn't cater for everyone at half time, and Middlesbrough went through on penalties, 8-7. I mean, the perfect upset. Manchester United miss a penalty, miss some amazing chances. Middlesbrough's goal probably shouldn't have stood. Wilson, it's ideal in upset terms, isn't it?
Yeah, I was following that on the Guardian minute by minute, because that was the only way of getting it in Cameroon, and I sort of intended to have quite an early night and end up being gripped by it, and it's because it was one of those games that sort of, when the draw happened, particularly with Chris Wilder coming in at Middlesbrough, you sort of thought, yeah, the way United are playing, they could be in trouble there. And yeah, sure enough, that's how it panned out.
I mean, as it went, Simon, they probably should have won, shouldn't they?
And they had the chances. They had 30 shots, which is, I mean, that's an extraordinary number of shots to be taking. And some of them, some of their chances were extraordinarily good. I mean, particularly there was the Bruno Fernandes one, where the goalkeeper was passing the ball out of the penalty area, but central in the pitch, he hassled his opponent, nicked the ball off him. And I mean, it seemed just an easy finish, but he somehow prodded it wide. There was the penalty that went wide. There was a late header. I mean, they had pretty straightforward opportunities to score the goals to win the game. Absolutely. Didn't happen. It was like one of those nights.
It was one of those nights. And also, Ben, I think I would have been disappointed if that Middlesbrough goal had been scored against me, given the handball.
Yeah, I think, Borough sort of hung in and they came on pretty strong, I thought. Chris Wilder has done an unbelievable job there. I was just going to say, Max, let me just sort of give a mention to Sol Bamba. I know he has played, obviously. It's not like this is his comeback, but I just thought it was brilliant for somebody like him, given his story, to come back. I think he had blood cancer, chemotherapy for that, 37, I believe, and to come back and be a part of it and to put the penalty away as he did.
Yeah.
It was just amazing. And I think, there's that cliche, isn't there, about, these great characters around the dressing room. I know it's the sort of thing that Roy Keane would be sort of spewing about, but I think Sol Bamba genuinely is that. And come off the bench in that game up at Old Trafford and then to, like I said, put the penalty away as he did, arguably the best penalty of the night, some finish for a centre-half.
I did enjoy, on Sunday, the Cardiff fans at Anfield singing "You're Just a Shit Sol Bamba" at Van Dijk.
Bamba tweeted after the game on Friday saying, too old for this shit, didn't he? So he's, a great moment.
ESPN tweeted that Manchester United have never won a penalty shootout in the 151-year history of the FA Cup. Thank you to Barry, who pointed out they've only been in three and no team won in the first 119 of those 151 years. So it's not quite the stat that ESPN were suggesting.
I think Manchester United did lose, the first ever English club to lose a penalty shootout in the Watney Cup. I think George Best was the first player ever to miss a penalty for an English club. I think that's true.
All right. Okay. Well, there's no one here to contest it, Wilson. Like everything else you say, could all be bollocks your entire career, but none of us will ever know. Elanga, disappointingly and predictably, was targeted with racist abuse after the game. Abuse was highlighted, actually, by the Aberdeen striker, J. Emmanuel Thomas, tweeted screenshots with the caption "so easy to predict." The offensive messages were removed. A spokesperson for Meta, Instagram's parent company, said it was in direct contact and supporting Elanga and that it had worked quickly to remove abusive comments from Elanga's account. Will continue to take action on anything that breaks our rules. They said, the spokesperson said, no one should have to experience racist abuse on social media. We don't tolerate it on our apps. Adding Meta is continuing to work with the industry and government to prevent abuse. Let's go to Stamford Bridge. Chelsea 2, Plymouth 1. How much, Ben, do we feel for Ryan Hardy missing that penalty in the last minute of extra time? Jonathan Pearce on comms said, a chance to step into Plymouth immortality, putting even more pressure on him. And it was a bit of a rubbish penalty. And you just think, oh, that's so brutal.
Yeah, a bit of a U-turn. It would have been amazing, wouldn't it? I mean, Plymouth, I think, were expected to, you know, really get hit by, I don't know, three or four there. And to go 1-0 up and stay in the game, obviously, as long as they did, pretty impressive, I would say. They've had a little wobble of late in League One as well, and Chelsea's team was so strong. Again, like Simon said earlier, I think it was a really good weekend for the FA Cup. Even teams that didn't quite get over the line, you know, Kidderminster, Plymouth, had beyond a go. You know, it was almost ridiculous in terms of how far they took it, how late they took these games. And yeah, I just think it is that thing where people are happy to knock the FA Cup. But there's been so many good examples. Even Cheltenham last season against Man City had a really good go for 83 minutes, I think they were leading. It's a great competition, and we saw it again across the round. But yeah, it Chelsea, Plymouth, oh so close.
Yeah, I've actually watched Plymouth this season. They're a really good team. I mean, they play really good football. They really get it down, and they, you know, and I didn't expect them to get anything out of this game, but I just feel it. Sometimes, you know, you saw like the Cardiff goal against Liverpool, they had their moment, they got to celebrate that goal. But when you're that close, you know, or when you have that moment, okay, you score your goal, you go 1-0 up, that's great, you have that chance to celebrate. But the cheers when they got that penalty, and then for it to be missed, are just, it's just so, it's just so tough. I mean, fair play to Alonso and Azpilicueta, who at some point will star in like the remake of Cocoon, won't they? Because they're just still going and will never, ever end. Let's go to the City Ground. Nottingham Forest 4, Leicester City 1. Roscoe says, did you guys know that Leicester won the FA Cup last year? It completely passed me by, like a Sergio Ramos transfer. I did remember them winning it and Tielemans scoring a lovely goal. But Simon, they were absolutely battered by Nottingham Forest.
They were. I mean, it was a really chastening experience for Leicester, who were, I mean, they were so far off the pace. And what's happening at Nottingham Forest this season is remarkable and really enjoyable. They've got a genuinely exciting young team. They were, I mean, it's not a great advert for Chris Hughton, but they were bottom of the league when Hughton left in September and are now in the playoff places. And it's not just results. You know, they're playing exciting football with exciting players. Jed Spence, now there's a weird, like, what's he doing being loaned out by another Championship club? He's widely seen after his performances so far this season as one of the, what, two or three hottest talents outside the Premier League in English football. And he and Johnson in particular were really strong for Forest. Forest's right side, which everyone knew was where their principal threat was, but Leicester couldn't control it. And they just created chance after chance. You know, they scored four, could have been more. And Leicester had no answers.
Joe Worrell scored a header. And I like Joe Worrell because he came on a radio show I was doing and read The Hungry Caterpillar, like Jack and Nori, during the lockdown, when footballers couldn't refuse to come on the radio because we all knew where they were, i.e. at home, like the rest of us. But he sort of celebrated in front of the Leicester fans. It was another case of football fans being incapable of dealing with a footballer just celebrating in their face. And a Leicester fan ran on and tried to punch one of the Forest players. I'm not sure if it was Joe Worrell he tried to punch. Leicester said in a statement, the club is appalled by such behaviour, offers its apologies to Nottingham Forest and its players whose safety was compromised. We applaud the swift action taken by City Ground stewards in apprehending the individual involved, who will be subject to a lifetime ban from all Leicester fixtures, home and away. On the pitch, Brendan Rodgers said, I can see some worrying signs. It's an interesting state that Leicester are sort of currently in, because they put out a good side for this game.
And you sort of felt with the substitutions as well, it was a very much a kind of let's not make this totally humiliating series of substitutions. But so the rest of this season, I've sort of almost been giving a free pass to because they've had such terrible injuries. You know, the defence has been totally unsettled. They've had issues at the back of midfield as well. And so you sort of think, well, any club who had those injuries, you've got to make allowances for. They'll be mid-table. There's no great shame in that. But then there's that nagging doubt as well that Brendan Rodgers does tend to have a shelf life at clubs. That it does seem to be after, you know, he's getting to the third season, players maybe start to doubt him, start to question him. You know, we've seen that pattern before. And so I'm not quite sure whether it's just the injuries or whether there is something, you know, those natural rhythms, those natural cycles, whether they're starting to take hold as well.
Just a few other notes from the games before we move on to AFCON. Liverpool beat Cardiff 3-1. I wonder, Simon, if Cardiff were a little bit unlucky. Could have been a red card for Kelleher. Cardiff could have had a penalty both at 0-0.
Yeah, I thought it probably was a penalty. It was a little bit... it was probably more 70-30, 80-20 than 50-50, that call, I thought. Kelleher... And there's a slightly strange thing with denying clear goal scoring opportunities where if a defender takes out an attacking player but the goalkeeper remains behind them, that is a denying a clear goal scoring opportunity and they would be sent off. But on this occasion, the goalkeeper took out the attacking player.
Yes.
There was potentially a defender behind them, potentially. But because the defender's there, it's not a goal-scoring opportunity. It's just a bit weird. Does one player, left back, make it a goal-scoring opportunity or not a goal? I mean, it's a bit weird. I thought there wasn't a lot of contact, but on replays, there definitely was some. And I suppose I'd prefer a player to stay on the pitch rather than go off if there's any room for doubt. But taken as a pair of decisions, they both went in favour of the home team, the favourites, and it would be a bit galling. I thought that the Cardiff manager was pretty gracious in defeat afterwards. He didn't make at all a big deal of the Kelleher decision. He was a little bit unhappy about the penalty, but he wasn't stamping his feet and making it about the officiating. So credit to him for that.
Yeah, well done to Frank Lampard, first win as Everton manager. Wilson, at some point we'll get you to do a deep dive on whether you think Frank Lampard is a good appointment for Everton. Fulham had 2 minutes to enjoy and dream at the Etihad before City equalised, then went on to win. Stuart Armstrong's goal for Southampton against Coventry was absolutely beautiful, and the angle, the camera angle right behind it, lovely. Harry Kane's got a nice goal. And Shane says, has Max got over his Cambridge-related strop from yesterday? Like, I tweeted that Cambridge didn't play well, but Luton weren't great either. And it did sound like sour grapes, and it shouldn't have been. I just said it wasn't a great advert for the red button, and they should have perhaps put a different game on. But well done to Dirty Luton and to Fake Carruthers, who host the pod on Wednesday as a celebration. And that'll do for part one. Oh, no, it won't. Burnley drew 0-0 with Watford in the Premier League in the most predictable result in Premier League history.
I thought that was going to be part two. Does that not stand alone with its own special
section? We're doing a whole special on it. A whole hour long.
It's Watford's first clean sheet for about six managers, isn't it, in the Premier League?
And he got so wet, Roy. I just wondered, like, in the horizontal rain at Turf Moor, did he think I should have stayed retired? And, you know, Sol Bamba tweeting, I'm too old for this shit. It'd have been great if Roy Hodgson had quote tweeted it and said, me too. Wouldn't it? Anyway, that'll do for part one. We'll do AFCON in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So then, Senegal win AFCON for the first time in their history. It was all about Sadio Mane. Missed one after 4 minutes, scored the decisive one in the shootout. And as you wrote in your piece, Wilson, once it went to penalties, history was stacked against Sadio Mane, and it was stacked against Senegal, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't. I mean, no team has ever won a tournament by winning three penalty shootouts. But you did sort of think, if any team could do that, it's this Egypt. They've won six penalty shootouts in a row. They've been playing for penalties pretty much since minute one of the group stage. I've never seen such a negative team with such good players. The idea that you have in your team arguably the most on-form forward in the world, and you choose to play like that. You choose not to play, essentially. So last night, the 90 minutes of normal time, the ball was in play for 40 minutes and 26 seconds, which is an absolute scandal. And that's to do with Egypt, and it's to do with the referee, the South African Victor Gomez, who just let him get away with it. And he would have lengthy chats to Mohamed Salah rather than, you know, telling him to go away and getting on with the game. He allowed players to stay down getting treatment when they clearly weren't injured. So that, you know, to put it in context, the Premier League average is 52 to 55 minutes. So we're talking about a fall off of well over 20%. Now, quite apart from the fact that that's cheating, if you are the Confederation of African Football and you're trying to present a product to show to the world, and particularly in a tournament which feels like it always has to sort of justify its existence, which is not particularly fair on CAF, but it does have issues of presentation that other tournaments don't have. If your game is then not a game at all, it's just people lying about or referees chatting to people, that is really, really bad. So, yeah, I thought it was an awful game. There's been far too much of it in the tournament. I think Egypt have been an absolute disgrace from start to finish. But, yeah, it was great for Senegal. A lot of Senegalese people in Yaoundé. On the way to the stadium, I went past Senegalese embassy and there was huge queues of people outside. I think they were queuing for tickets. I'm not entirely certain, but there was a load of buses that they were all getting on as well. And yeah, the atmosphere low, there's probably only about 35,000 there in a 60,000 capacity stadium, although capped at 48,000 for COVID regulations. The atmosphere was actually pretty good. There was a couple of thousand Egyptians had come in and loads of Senegalese.
Give us an idea of how, I mean, it sounds like a stupid question. How important is this for Senegal, right? How close have they got in the past? How often have they been, you know, there or thereabouts and to finally get over the line?
I mean, it's enormous for them in that they'd never won it before. So they're the one sort of major African footballing nation who hadn't previously won it. I think they weren't really much of a footballing nation until sort of 20, 30 years ago. They got to the final in 2002 in Mali when they lost. This will shock you, it was 0-0 draw on penalties. So five of the last 11 have been 0-0 in penalties. Aliou Cissé, who's currently the manager, he missed a decisive penalty against Cameroon in that final. And then in Cairo in 2019, it was actually not a dissimilar game to this one, that Algeria had been a lot better than Egypt have been in this tournament. And I think we're pretty obviously the best side in the tournament in 2019. But they scored very early in the final and then pretty much just killed the game for the next 89 minutes and Senegal couldn't get going. So it did feel it sort of slipped into that trap again. And then from Mane's point of view, he missed. I was in Franceville in Gabon in 2017 when he missed the decisive penalty against Cameroon in the quarterfinal. He missed two penalties in 2019. So for him then to miss after, I don't actually know what minute it was the penalty was taken. I know the foul was in the third minute, but it felt like about half an hour before he got taken the penalty. For him to miss that, and then it's all on him in the shootout. And the thing is, even in the shootouts, I'm still certain Egypt were going to win, because the first penalty they missed was a great penalty. It was like 2 inches off being the perfect penalty. It smashed off inside the post with Mendy having gone the wrong way. That was Abdelmonem, who's had a great tournament despite conceding the penalty yesterday. And then suddenly the substitute, Shaheen, with an absolutely dreadful penalty out of nowhere. And he's turned the eye on. If Mane scores this, they've won. And it seemed to sort of come from nowhere. And then he absolutely leathered it. You sort of got this sense of a real cathartic release. And Abu Ghabal, the Egypt keeper, who'd been brilliant. I mean, he only came into the tournament, I think it was the 88th minute, the last 16 game, he came on for El Shaarawy. But he's been the keeper of the tournament. He's been, I think he saved five penalties. But he couldn't get down quickly enough to it. And then Mane, you know, sometimes when you see a player run off and celebrate by themselves, you sort of think, is he being a bit of a prima donna? Is he sort of taking all the glory for himself? But I think that was just the relief and the release. And he's sort of skipping around the running track with the Senegalese flag. Before everybody eventually sort of catches up with him.
Simon, it was fun, the first penalty, seeing Salah, you know, telling telling his teammate where Mane was going to put it, and Mane saying, no, I think I'll put it in that corner instead. I enjoyed that bit.
Yes. For a moment there, it looked like we were going to have an exciting final. But then the penalty was well saved. It wasn't a great penalty. It was much too central. But it was well saved and pushed well clear of goal. And from there on, it went downhill, really. And there was a point where the BBC commentator said they had been hearing Victor Gomez's whistle in his sleep.
It was 52 fouls in the game.
And some of the decision-making... Koulibaly was booked for jumping, and he didn't seem to do anything more than jump or make any particular contact with anyone. But he was then booked for jumping, and other people weren't booked, despite having already been booked and making, you know, numerous fouls thereafter. And he more or less encouraged players to go down and spend as long as they wanted doing it by rewarding them for doing so in the opening minutes of the game. And, you know, I do think that it is possible to stand up to Egypt and to force them through your officiating to do less gamesmanship. Anyway, it didn't happen. And as Jonathan said, this is the great showpiece of African football. And it was not a great advert.
What have you made of the tournament as a whole, Wilson?
It hasn't been great, to be honest. We come back to this issue over and over again. I don't really know what the solution is. But obviously the tragedy overshadows everything. It's only 2 weeks ago. The semi-final, so the Alembe, eight people were killed in the crush outside the Alembe at the last 16. And, you know, if you come to this stadium, the level of incompetence you need to create a crush is spectacular. It's a brilliant stadium. It's the best stadium I've ever been to in Africa. And there's loads of space outside. So how they managed to create that bottleneck, it's just... When I went there the day after the tragedy to try and work out what had happened, it was very hard then, but you could sort of see where there were some barriers that had been knocked down and you could see, you know, the evidence on the ground of what had happened. But the semi-final, so the quarter-final was moved to the other Yaounde Stadium, which is smaller and ramshackle and you know, really facilities aren't very good there at all. And then they decided that, you know, with I think they put in place a 27-point plan. So they did that great thing in the report of blaming fans and then blaming whoever first shut and then opened the relevant gate. And so say, yeah, it's their fault. CAF takes no legal responsibility. And then piece a 27-point programme for how they're going to make it better, which rather suggests that those 27 points might have been followed the first time round. But the semi-final, I tried to go in where the press box is at the west entrance, and security wouldn't let me. I had to go round to the south entrance, which is where the disaster happened. So they were literally, again, funneling people through that same gate. And that's a really odd feeling, you know, to be walking on that ground where you know people died. So I think it's been a pretty depressing tournament from a very obvious level that 8 people died, but also the organisation's been really poor and I don't think the football's been very good.
And the difficulty with that is, you know, in the lead up to the competition, there's all this conversation about respecting the tournament. And for the people who are critical of this tournament, it's much easier for them to say, well, look, it's badly organised, the football isn't great, so why should we respect it? Does that make sense? I mean, obviously we should respect it.
That completely makes sense. And so I think there's 2 things to be said about that. So one is, to be absolutely fair to CAF, they were forced to compromise when players were released. So players played in those games on January the 2nd, which meant they had 8 days of preparation. That was further complicated by the fact so many people had COVID. So I think, I mean, in Senegal's case, did they have 5 out with COVID in the build-up to the first game? Koulibaly came back and was awful in his first game. And he's obviously a brilliant player, so you saw the impact COVID had had on him. So I think, to an extent, the poverty of the football, you can explain by the poor preparation. But, you know, on a wider level, that is a worry looking ahead to the World Cup, because we've got games in the Premier League 9 days before the World Cup starts. So if preparation time is an issue, and of course it's an issue, that's going to be a problem at the World Cup as well. So I suspect the first round of games at the World Cup are going to be terrible on the same principle. And then the other point is you have an instance, as happened in that Mali-Tunisia game with Yannis Akazwa, the Zambian referee who blew up early twice. And everybody's response, or it was everybody's response, the response of Europe is to sort of go, ah, oh, look, yeah, it's just nonsense again, can't even sort of play the full 90 minutes. It turns out Yannis Akazwa had heat stroke. And that he's done an interview where he says, I literally didn't know, people were talking to me, I couldn't hear them. And the headpiece was too hot, and I just needed to take the headpiece out, and I just needed to get off the pitch. And he was actually saying that he thinks if he hadn't stopped the game early, he might have, you know, genuinely been in serious medical trouble. Now, that could happen to any referee. A referee refereeing in heat and humidity could get heat stroke. And I think in normal circumstances or in other circumstances, you would be sympathetic to him. But the instinct of everybody is to go, ah, look, more nonsense, more chaos. And that's because there is a lot of chaos. It fits into that general narrative. And it's very unfair on Yannis Akazwa, who, you know, he did the final of the Cup of Nations in 2017. He's refereed at World Cups. He's obviously a very good referee. And rather than him getting the sympathy he's probably due, he just sort of gets a bit of mockery of, oh, you know, it's CAF being useless again.
We should mention the third place playoff, which was like an amazing game, Wilson. Burkina Faso 3-0 up, and then their goalkeeper had a really terrible 20 minutes. And Cameroon came back to draw 3-3, scoring the 85th and 87th minute.
There's also one of the Burkina Faso goals came because Andre Onana had swallowed an insect and was vomiting on the pitch and then bumped on his own nest. Apparently, literally, people behind the goal said to him, go down, go down. And then, no, I'll be fine.
Do we know what insect it was? I mean, I suppose he swallowed it. So
there were a lot of moths about, I think, attracted by the floodlights. So I would assume a moth, but I have not forensically examined that.
Fair enough. There once was a goalkeeper who swallowed a fly, I guess. Anyway, look, Cameroon won it 5-3 on penalties. And they really, like the celebrations for a third, fourth playoff were huge in this game.
Yeah, they were. I mean, I was surprised by how seriously they took it. I think it was, I mean, Abubakar getting two goals. He's got 8 in the tournament, which only once before has anybody scored more than 8 in a Cup of Nations. To score 8 goals when only 100 were scored in the tournament, it's sort of the equivalent of Charles Bannerman in the first ever Ashes test, scoring 67.35% of Australia's runs. You suspect that a player scoring 8% of the goals in the 2014 tournament will never happen again. So I was delighted for him because he's been really good all tournament. And that I guess, gives Cameroon something tangible. But yeah, there was mass celebrations. And I think it was a sense that they had been able to take something from the tournament. Because, you know, the Cameroonians have been waiting for this for 50 years. You know, 1972 was the last time they hosted the Cup of Nations, when they also lost in the semi-final. Now, depending exactly what you count as a competitive game, they haven't lost at home in a competitive game since 1973. So I guess by getting back to 3-3, they preserved that record, which is something at least.
Finally, and probably least importantly, a question from, I think it's pronounced Geroid, G-E-R-O-I-D. So apologies if I've mispronounced that. Of all the major international trophies, which do you think would be best to defend yourself? AFCON is my weapon of choice. It's kind of like the World Cup, but with a sort of mace-like sort of studs around the outside. I think it would be more an offensive weapon than a defensive weapon. I think maybe the UEFA Cup might be quite a strong...
No, I think the UEFA Cup's too heavy. I think it'd be really hard to... You could defend yourself with the UEFA Cup. I don't think you could attack anybody with the UEFA Cup. You talk to, Liverpool captains and people who've won it, and they say that when you just played sort of 90 minutes in heat, trying to lift the UEFA Cup is a nightmare. Whereas the Cup of Nations, I think, is kind of... Yeah, it's obviously not... I don't think it's as heavy as the World Cup. It looks like something you could really sort of grip hold of one-handed and have a good swing with it.
What about the Women's World Cup? That's got a pointy end that might come in handy. Like, it's clubbable, but there's also a point. I reckon that might be.
Yes, that's quite good. I mean, the Stanley Cup, if we're branching out, I mean, it's about the size of a house. You'd have to be quite strong. Also, Women's Wimbledon.
Yeah, Women's Wimbledon is literally a shield, isn't it? So
yeah, that would be the one. Yeah. I guess any shield is really, that is the best defensive. Anyway, let us know if you have any advances on those. Footballweekly at theguardian.com. And that'll do for part two. Part three, Susie will join us for some WSL plus any other business, and then we'll all go home. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Susie Rack joins us to talk about the WSL. Hey, Susie, how are you?
I am not bad. How are you?
Yeah, excellent. Thanks. A couple of big games in the WSL. Arsenal 1, Manchester United 1, Chelsea beat Man City 1-0. The Arsenal game first. Stina Blackstein has scored a late equaliser, but the pass from Miedemar was a thing of absolute beauty, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing of beauty. It says it that you've got a whole load of players in the stands saying it's the, you know, tweeting Leah Williamson and stuff, saying it's the best pass they've ever seen. Yeah, it's just the vision of it. You know, I think you're sitting there and you just do not expect her to play it through the middle like that. And it just, it's, for me, it's the way it bounces so nicely and perfectly into her stride, into Stina Blackstenius' stride, that is so perfect about it. She doesn't even have to take a first touch to sort of bring it under control. It's in control for her already. That's the beauty of it. And it's a shame from an Arsenal point of view that it was only to equalise, but it was, the thing of beauty.
Did they deserve more, do you think?
Probably not. Man United have been really, really excellent sort of since probably about the start of December. They're a really well organised team. Mark Skinner's a great manager. I know a lot of the fans were quite sceptical of him, his appointment when he was brought in the summer. He hadn't had the best record in the US. He wasn't particularly liked in the US. He had started to turn things around at Orlando Pride. In his first season there, they had their worst ever points finish, bottom of the league. But when he left, they had their best ever start to a season and were actually doing not too badly. So I thought, you know, United fans were maybe a little bit quick to judge him. And, you know, because he wasn't particularly liked in the States, you know, he didn't have the best reputation there. But here, his reputation's really strong. He did a really, really good job at Birmingham on really limited resources before he went there. And he's, you know, he's showing how good he is as a manager since he's been at United. They're really organised. They're a really, really well organised team. And they've got really, really brilliant young attacking English talent. Alessia Russo, Ella Toon, Leah Galton. And they were always going to cause Arsenal loads and loads of trouble. And they did very early on. If anything, United perhaps deserved to edge the game over Arsenal.
Chelsea beat City 1-0. They're just 2 points behind Arsenal. They've got a game in hand on Arsenal. They play each other on Friday, which it sort of feels like a title decider, whether it's too early to say that it is or not. You know, and Arsenal beat Chelsea, didn't they, on the opening day, and that was such a massive start for the league. Who are the favourites now? Chelsea, do you think?
100% Chelsea. Arsenal aren't playing particularly well. Lack any kind of consistency, but also seem to go missing in games that they go behind in. They don't really know what to do. They look a little bit clueless. Whereas Chelsea have just got this, grit about them that I think comes from all of Emma Hayes' teams. She's just got a way of pulling together players that just, you know, are leaders on the pitch that can find the answer if there's a problem. If they go behind, they know what to do. And Arsenal don't really have that. I mean, obviously, Friday night is going to be absolutely huge, and it's unpredictable because Arsenal are unpredictable. They, on their day, start of the season, could absolutely smash Chelsea, but equally, you know, they could get completely battered like they did in the FA Cup final, which at this stage is probably the more likely scenario, worryingly, for me as an Arsenal fan. It's got to be... It's Chelsea's to lose, and I don't think they'll slip up now. Now they've got the opportunity to take top spot in the league for the first time this season. I don't think they're gonna let it go. What was impressive about the Man City game was it was just a really, really controlled performance. They never seemed untroubled by City having spells of the game. Dominating possession. They never seemed too bothered by it. They were quite relaxed defensively because they were just so well organised and so well drilled as a group, which is impressive given that only Millie Bright has been a regular starter in the back line in the last 2 years. All of the others have sort of come in as placeholders for people that are injured or or have been sold and then there's been an injury or whatever it may be. You know, they're all, you know, a year ago you wouldn't have said any of them would be a first choice centre-back or full-back for Chelsea, bar Millie Bright. And yet they put on a performance that stops a team that scored 37 goals in their last nine games with some of the best young English wingers in the country in their side. So, yeah, it's Chelsea's to lose. And I don't think they will. And I think they'll have the psychological edge going into Friday's game as well, because they were absolutely furious at the way Arsenal celebrated, particularly how Jonas Eidevall celebrated in the first game of the season. And there was a lot of that fueling the energy of the FA Cup final where they beat them 3-0. And I think we're going to see more of that, because after that game, Emma and the players were very clear, like, this is the first game of the season. Come at us in February. We've had barely any pre-season. Most of our players have been at the Olympics. We've given them rest. So we prioritise rest for our players over getting them ready for the start of the season. Arsenal prioritised getting ready for the start of the season and getting their players back quick. Let's see the results of that come the end of the season. They're going to be absolutely buzzing for it and desperate to prove their point.
Susie, you were tweeting a lot about Raith Rovers, as a lot of us were, about their decision to sign David Goodwillie. Shortly after we finished recording on Thursday's pod, the chairman released the second statement after the first very tin-eared statement, saying, "We got it wrong. In reaching our original decision, we focused far too much on football matters, not enough on what this decision would mean for our club and the community as a whole. Over the past couple of days, we listened carefully to the fans who've got in touch. I'm very grateful for their honesty. As chairman, as a board and as a management team, we've all learned a hard but valuable lesson." What do you make of the second statement and their decision to not play David Goodwillie at all?
Oh, well, I mean, it's good they finally made the right decision. You know, I'm not saying that no one can, you know, that people can't rehabilitate themselves. But I think there's a big difference between being allowed to rehabilitate yourself in a role that thrusts you in the public spotlight and in front of, you know, young children as screaming fans and things like that. I think there's a big difference in that. If they wanted to help his rehabilitation, they could have done so in a very, very different way. But, yeah, I mean, the statement itself is appalling, and I don't think they've done enough in that statement to rectify the absolute mess that they caused with the first statement in signing him on in the first place. You know, if you look at it, why are the board still there? Who made that decision? Who wrote that statement? Who allowed that statement to go through? The first one, I'm saying. You know, there should be more heads rolling than just his for this. Like, it's outrageous that someone thought it was okay to write that this is a footballing decision, and allowed that to go out into the public. And I think that the board that approved that should go. I don't think it's acceptable that you have people that think that that's a okay thing to put out into the world. Should be able to run a football club, especially as there's, you know, there's been sort of no, like, this is what we're going to do to remedy the situation. You know, we're going to do, you know, some diversity training. We're going to, as a board, you know, get Rape Crisis in to discuss the issue. We're going to, you know, sponsor a local refuge and go and do some volunteering there. We want to learn about this problem and understand why this caused as much outrage as it did. That it's just we made the wrong shout. We've changed our minds, and I don't think that's quite good enough. Why have you changed your minds? Tell us. You know, what was the tipping point? Was it all the sponsors pulling out? Was it the women's team cutting away entirely? You know, was it finally when it started to hit the pockets that it actually tipped things, or was it, you know, a genuine understanding of the cause of the anger and frustrations of a lot of people, including women, but a lot of people generally? You know, and I don't think they've done enough to establish that they actually understand what they did was wrong and why it was wrong. And I think more needs to be done in that sense, and to just rebuild trust with the local community generally, particularly obviously local women, to actually be able to move forward. And I don't think the board are capable of that personally, but that's my opinion.
Susie, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it as always.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Susie right there, The Guardian's women's football correspondent. On to any other business. Briefly, Wilson, Sunderland lost at home to bottom of the table Doncaster. The Roy Keane, I don't know what the latest is on Roy Keane, but your general thoughts if he was to become your manager?
Well, I mean, he was really good for about a season and a half at Sunderland the first time around. I know things have gone badly for him since, but I sort of felt something got rid of him slightly prematurely. There's obviously a personality issue between him and Ellis Short, the then owner. I think he would definitely give the club a lift that it probably needs at the minute. Oh, you saw a dismal recent run, you know, not losing Doncaster, but getting beat. Conceding six at Bolton the previous game. So, I want some sort of random young Dutchman I've never heard of, but I'd rather have Roy Keane than one of these sort of generic League One managers who suddenly keep on appointing. At the very least, it would be entertaining. It would definitely get... I mean, I don't know what the crowd was actually on Saturday. I know that just before kickoff, it sold 36,000 tickets, which is incredible. And now it's partly Jermaine Defoe coming back. So they could be touching 40,000, which for a League One club who've been really pretty average for a long time, that would be astonishing. I'm going up there for the MK Dons game, which is the next home match, which is... When's that? It's a week come Saturday. So if that were Roy Keane's home debut, that would suit me very well.
Paul says, what's in more trouble, Australian football or Neighbours? Yeah, this is the devastating news that Neighbours may not be carrying on British TV or at all. So, you know, I will not let this happen on my watch, is all I'm saying. I will pull out all the stops to make sure that Dr. Carl and team and Paul Robinson and Lassitus and Mr. Udigawa and Helen Daniels and Madge and Bouncer still have a place to play. So leave it with me. Disappointing news for our ski jumper, the Guardian Football Weekly's only competitor in Beijing, Halvor A. Granerud. Hello, Halvor, if I hopefully pronounced that correctly. He didn't make the podium, but he said, not the day I dreamed about, but new days will come. Cool podium. Congrats to the three medal winners. But you are our winner, Halvor, unless, of course, any of the three winners are also Football Weekly fans, in which case, get in touch. And before I say goodbye to everyone, Charlie says, as Ellis James is now possibly the most well-known Potter in intellectual circles due to his news quiz affiliations, Sid appearing on University Challenge a close second, surely he is the man to be reading out the post-pod credits for producer Joel. So, we got Ellis to do it, and that'll happen in just a second. But for the time being, thank you so much for your time. Thanks, Wilson. Safe flight home.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Thank you, Simon.
Great pleasure.
You almost sounded sarcastic, Simon, at the...
No, never. Never. I wouldn't.
Face back on Wednesday. I'll be back on Friday.
Guardian Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. The executive producer was Max Sanderson or Daniel Stevens, we're not sure yet. The football editor is Marcus Christensen. The sports editor is Will Woodward. The editor is Kath Finer.
This is The Guardian.